On March 9th, the Maud Kearns Art Gallery held an artist talk about bricolage. Local mad bricoleur Dan Pillars describes bricolage as creating with random materials while puttering about. Rogine Manias has changed her medium.
So much goes into our landfill. There's a statistic, and I think I have it on the display in the back. By the way, I did this whole thing called the Guide to Used Goods. There's more than 100 locations where you can buy used materials in Eugene and Springfield. And I assembled all those and created a place online where you can go there with a QR code or through a website link, which is in the back there if you want that, that will show you all these different places where you can buy used goods. As far as, you know, using materials, like things having a second life, you know, this is just one way that we're repurposing materials. There should be many, many, many more ways of reusing our discards, because our landfills are just filled to the brim. We're going to be buried in garbage. We're burying our children's future in garbage. And so I'm all about sustainability now. And how has this changed my practice? I'm probably going to stick with this. I mean, I really like the other work that I've always done, painting and sculpting and, you know, paper clay work. But, you know, the paper clay that I used is shipped in a plastic bag from Japan. All of that is costing us. You know, it's costing the future. So if the more I can do myself, I'm just doing a little thing here, but, you know, maybe our community can do more to keep things from the landfill by trying to find a second use for it.
Exhibits coordinator Liberty Rossell has lots of fun stuff coming up at the Maud Kearns.
So we are going to have our first installation of Jake and the Hellcats. They are a student-led jazz group, and their motivation has been to create jazz performances that relate to the work. So they get images beforehand, and they kind of think about some compositions, and then do a little bit of impromptu. Well, we just had a very successful collage workshop today that's finished up, so keep an eye out for any sort of collage meetings here every month or every other month. It's kind of new for us. Every other month. Anne Bum Hamilton is one of the leaders of it, along with Beth I. Robinson. Thank you, everyone.
For more information, go to mkartcenter.org. For KPW News,
thank you, everyone, for coming here today for our artist talk of the art of bricolage. Here we have four different artists. We have Rogine Manias on my left, Michael Whitenack, Dan Pillars, and Marjorie Taylor. And they're going to be speaking about their artwork for about 45, 50 minutes, and then we're going to have a short Q&A at the very end. All right, so I will first have Rogine speak about how this entire show came together. We have a work of 9 different artists, all from Oregon. And to begin with, what is bricolage? Bricolage is defined as the creation or construction from a range of available things. And so with that, it kind of gives you a little bit of insight about what this artwork is about. But Rogine will get us started with, how did this come together? What brought you to these 8 other artists? And what was your vision to start us out?
Hi, and thank you all for coming. I know it's, you know, other things to do on a Saturday, so it's really very special for us that you're all here. And I submitted a proposal, I think it was almost 3 years ago, for a show. And I had this idea that I wanted to promote sustainability and less waste in the world. And so I reached out to Michael and asked him if he would do it with me. And he said yes. And then we were like, well, that's a big gallery, so maybe we need another person. So then I reached out to Marjorie. And then still the 3 of us were like, wow, that's still a lot of work. So then I started looking into friends that I knew or followed on Instagram in Portland, and Stephanie Brockaway, who's not here today, but she does these, this is Stephanie Brockaway's piece here. She connected me with Dan, and then Dan connected me with Mavis, who does the fabric pieces. And it just kept going from there. And there was one other person that I reached out to. It was a first time show that she's ever done a show before. and Esther Finch is what she goes by, and say, the dog over there is one of her pieces on the wall. And very proud of her because she went through a lot of personal difficulty in the last 2 years and still pulled off having artwork for this show. I also then, I tried to get a grant because I had this grandiose idea of making this like a citywide event and, you know, and here I am, this one-man show. I'm a graphic designer, and so I created materials, you know, to make it look like it was really going to be something, and I didn't get the grant, so I kind of did, I fell back to my plan B, which was just to do as much as I could by sending emails to people, and I did get the support of St. Vincent de Paul, Goodwill, Buffalo Exchange, Bring, and let me see, Mecca. And they all provided discount coupons that are back there on the table. If you're interested in shopping at those places, they all sell used goods, and you would be amazed at the art materials that are available in those places. And I wanted to say that for my pieces, mine are 100% recycled. So every single thing that I used was either I purchased at a secondhand store or I, you know, used, you know, garbage. So, but that includes the glue and the finishings and even some paintbrushes and black paint. And anyway, it's all available out there. And so I hate to not support our local art supply stores because they need support too. But when you're looking for standard goods, you know, I would recommend trying secondhand. In addition to all that, I reached out to Kelly Bell, who is the head of the recycling program, master recycling program, and she connected me with Daniel Heisted and Tanya Shepherd, and they, those two people, in conjunction with eWeb and 4J, paid for, or are planning to pay for, I don't know what's happening, school field trips to come here and see this show, which I really wanted to encourage, but, you know, without the grant, I couldn't do that much. But I do hope that maybe in the future that this idea could happen again in Eugene, and maybe on a more public level where everybody can make art from recycled materials and have a wonderfully big show of everybody's efforts. One thing that was really important to me was to choose artists who would make work that really was well crafted. And all of the artists in this show, I feel, you know, really did a fabulous job of that. And it's, you know, finishing is everything when you're working with recycled materials. Right when I got the grant, I notified the artist, and then I immediately went for a month-long trip to Chiapas, where I was staying in San Cristobal de las Casas. And when I went, I thought, okay, I'm not taking any art supplies. I'm only taking tools. And I had some old canvas that I got at a garage sale, so I cut up a bunch of small canvases and started working on those. And when I was down there, I thought, okay, I'm gonna just find things around town and that I could use. Well, when you're down in a community that is poverty-stricken, there are no waste materials. It was really hard to find recycled materials down there because they use everything. They don't have mountains of landfill like we do. They have our mountains of rejected clothing, you know, that they're going through, and, you know, I mean, and even if, you know, even if nobody wants to wear it, they cut it up in strips and make quilts and blankets and, you know, things to sell. Anyway, that was very inspiring. So I just wanted to say a few things about the pieces that I have in the show. I tried all different kinds of things because, unlike my friends here, I don't usually work in this medium. I don't usually, I'm a mixed media artist, but I don't usually work with bits of paper and stuff like that. I'm kind of known as a paper clay artist. And so my first thing was to make things out of nature. And I have a few pieces, like the lady behind me on the wall up there that's holding the earth. Tried to incorporate bits and pieces of things that I found outside. And that's where I started with everything. And I'm going to, after this, I'm going to put out some pieces up here that you can see where I actually, to create a practice of it, which I recommend that. You know, you don't want to just jump into making work for a show if you've never done that before. So I started with a small practice of making smaller pieces. And I'll put some of them out here so you can see where I kind of evolved. So once I got the nature thing going, then I kind of got more interested in working with cardboard. And so that kind of begat, there's an owl on the wall back there and a piece in the other room that's made with cardboard. And then everything is on a substrate that I got from Mecca and repurposed, or Goodwill and repurposed. And then I started doing the magazine scraps, and that's the heron over there is 100% magazine scraps and tissue paper. And that piece, in order to know where I was going with it, and for the pieces like some of the kids on the wall, those pieces, I did do a black and white painting underneath it. So I got the black paint from Goodwill, and I used, and I had a thing of gesso from Mecca, and so those were my black and white. So I painted, there's a black and white painting underneath that, so I knew where I was gonna, it's hard to just start putting paper on a canvas and know where you're going when you're working with little tiny pieces. From there, I went to creating my Wheel of Worry that's on the wall over here, and that's I'm a graphic designer, so I made those words. You know, I did get those printed, so I guess I lied. That's 100%. That's, I don't know what percentage of paper that would be on there. But all the rest of it was secondhand stuff. And then and then finally I ended up doing a tissue paper collage with the, there's a polar bear up there, and use spackle to make his fur. Anyway, I just tried all different kinds of things, and it was so rewarding and interesting and fun to have the leash taken off of you, because usually if you are an artist and you want to sell your work, you have to be consistent. You have to put out a pretty consistent line of work so that galleries will accept you and carry you because they know what to expect from you. So it was really wonderful of Maude Kearns to give us this show. Where we could all just be experimental and try a whole diversity of mediums and ways of making art anyway. So thank you all for coming again, and I'm gonna hand this back over to.
And so what's interesting about this show is not only is it, you know, it's recycled art. Reduce, reuse, recycle, reimagine is one of the phrases for this show. But there was also a mission goal where 80% of the pieces, materials of their work had to be sustainably sourced. And so that was also really nice to have that hard number put in there.
No, this isn't the way I usually work. In fact, it was scary to me because I tend to work in wood, which I just feel totally comfortable manipulating. You know, I can make it do what I want it to do. So when we had this 80% kind of rule that we were trying to follow, and I decided that I would really try to push myself, which is what I really wanted to do, I find that I'm not the kind of artist that is compelled to produce all the time. Ronnie Rogine, I think, is in that mode. I get easily distracted. You know, I've got things, I've got grandkids, and all this stuff that happens in my life. So for me, an exhibition deadline is what I really look for. I'm a deadline-driven person. I'm really good if I got a deadline. I'm really bad if I don't have a deadline. So this was an opportunity to have a deadline and to try something new. I thought, this will be cool, you know, I'll be able to try some new stuff and so on. I'll tell you, I got scared so many times along the process because I'd go to Goodwill and Ring and all these places, and I'd walk around looking for inspiration and walk away, and I didn't come up with anything. You know, I just look at things and go, I don't see it. I didn't have a vision for it. So thank goodness we had a really long lead time between the time we knew we had this show and it actually happened. And typically the way I work, I think it came from years of working in the museum business and then design world, where I was trying to display other people's work, but there was always with some kind of theme or message. So my work tends to have, at least for me, a little narrative that's going in my head. You know, I start with an idea, and sometimes that idea is an NPR story, or I read in the newspaper or something, and then I illustrate it. And that's kind of what I've kind of 3D illustration of something I'm thinking about. So that's my normal working process. In this case, I was looking for materials that would inspire me. You know, I'd try to see something, and it just wasn't happening. Little piece back in the corner, that owl, that kind of silver little owl, was one of the first things that I did. My son-in-law's mom came to my studio when, maybe a year into thinking about this project, and she sent me this box from Michigan, full of all stuff. She said, I just cleaned out my closet, and here's a bunch of stuff. And so those, which became the legs to that owl, were like hem pants with, you know, what I don't know what those things are called, but there's some little feet, and you use it. So those became legs. And then I went to Goodwill and found a plumbing part, and then in that box was also some shoe lasts became wings, and so then I finally had one piece, and I'm like, okay, maybe it's gonna happen. Maybe I'll come. I just didn't want to, you know, be embarrassed of what I was putting out. So anyway, that's kind of the way I worked, and it's been really a fun process. It you know, I think the fear is a good motivator. So I worked through that process, and I suspect that in the future I'm going to incorporate more and more found and repurposed materials, just because it's now in my head, and I feel like, okay, you know, you find little plateaus in your work, and you're successful, and you feel like, okay, I can see how that could work. So, and all the little scraps of wood in my shop now also have new meaning. I can see, okay, I can put all these together and make something. Anyway, just a couple of words about individual pieces in terms of the recycled nature of them. The piece over here, which we call Old Bull, that was a trip to the coast. I found this beach log, and that thing at that time was heavy. I put it on my shoulder and hiked up this big hill. It sat in my studio for maybe 6-8 months, you know, and then idea came to me, and there you go, there was that one. And the bigger one back in the corner with the ears, those were all, the actual wood in that piece was used cedar decking from Ring. And so I wasn't used to laminating something up in quite that way, but, and it had all kinds of paint, nails had to be taken out of it, but that was fun. And then the ears are cardboard shoe lasts, and you know, for a variety of found and recycled materials. But cool. So I can see now kind of new avenues, new ways of producing. So the challenge was great. Thanks again for inviting me. And I'll pass the baton.
My work is the cabinets and the wall pieces over here with the shadows. I have been working with recycled material for virtually my entire life. When I was a young child, I had this fabulous grandmother who always provided me with a table full of old rickrack and bits and pieces of fabric and egg cartons and chicken bones and God knows what all, and would encourage us to make stuff with it. She always said, why buy it when you can make it? And so I often say that I came by it honestly, it's in my DNA. a few years ago, I was honored with the opportunity to be one of the Glean artists, and Glean is a program in Portland that works with Recology and Crackpots, which are both, Recology is an West Coast organization that deals with all of the dumps up and down the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And they've set up a program at various different cities where they have residencies for artists where we had access to the dump. And I was one of six artists that year, and it was a great opportunity. I got to go to the city, to the transfer station, and rifle through all your garbage. It's not the garbage that you take in, that you're going to be dumping out into your garbage cans per se, but more the stuff that you might go deliver to the dump yourself after you've cleaned out your attic or your yard debris or whatever. So in that sense, it was all relatively clean garbage. But I was in pig heaven. I just loved it. I have the word bricolage. Is a term that when Rogine was putting together the show, she was threw it out and said, "I don't know what to call the show." And I have been referring to my work as bricolage for a number of years. It came about, I had posted an image on Facebook or one of the social medias of myself in my studio. And a friend of mine who lives down in the San Francisco area responded to it, says, "It looks like the makings of a mad bricolaire." and I thought, wonder what that is. So I looked it up. And so it's a bricolaire, someone who creates bricolage. And then from there, I had to go down that rabbit hole. But I found one of the definitions of bricolage was to work with random materials, to create with random materials while puttering about. I looked at that and I said, nothing describes what I do more accurately. So that's when I started using the term bricolage. And it's always a point of conversation whenever I have a show, because oftentimes it's people are more interested in the term than they are in the art sometimes. But I work with, mine is created virtually entirely of salvage materials. Really the only thing that's not is some of the nails and so on that I use. My studio is in my basement. My husband has in the past referred to it as the landfill. it's filled with stuff. My process involves deconstruction, reimagining, and then building. So for instance, I might find an old chair. The first thing I do when I bring it into the house is I totally take it apart. It comes completely apart. I'm taking all the little brackets. If there's onlay, I'm prying that off. I'm saving some of the screws and all the bric-a-brac that might come with it. And those get sorted. They get completely taken out, and then they're sorted into my piles all over. That becomes the raw material. One of my most common asked questions in a show, and my least favorite question to be asked, is where do I find these cabinets? I don't find them. I build them. So you know, people look at them and think that they're an old antique cabinet from somewhere, but those are built entirely out of salvage materials. For instance, this piece over here, framing portion of those are of legs from an old dining room table that I've taken apart, and then I cut it and put the glass in. The glass is almost all either from old picture frames that I got like at Goodwill or someplace like that, or they're storm windows. I really like working with the storm windows because they've got, a lot of them have that that residual, you know, from the rains and stuff, the minerals that are built up on it, and I like that. I really like that. The etchings that I do, I use an etching cream. That is something that is bought new. Although while I was doing my residency at the Dome, I did find a stash of that, so that was handy. But for me, my work has a lot of social, political, and personal commentary. The artifacts that are placed with inside of the things are not directly from my past, but they're reminiscent of things from my past. And I will look at something and I will it will speak to me in some way and say, hey, this is what it needs to say. And then from there, I start to correct, I create what I need to do. My titles of my pieces are really important. My titles come first. So I know what it's called before I even get started. And a big portion of my process is my dreams. I build my work almost completely in my dreams before I actually start to construct it. I keep a little notebook by my bed and draw real rudimentary sketches of what I dreamt, make little notes about, you know, all possible materials and stuff. When I'm in the middle of working on stuff, oftentimes I'll be working and I get stuck. It's like, okay, how do I make this happen? I go to bed. Wake up in the morning, it's like, oh, that's how you do it. So, it's been handy to sort of do that, be able to do that in my sleep. And it's exciting to me. My stuff is coded. I have, for me, there's the placement of objects, the etched glass, the use of words in it. They all are a little bit of a hint, as well as a title, as to what I might have been thinking, and sort of guide you in a direction that might help you, you know, come to the same conclusion or your very own conclusion. I'm always interested when somebody will tell a story about your piece. That's, for instance, this piece behind me with the shadow of the raven. I was at a show and a young woman came up and she knew exactly what it was all about. And she proceeded to tell a story to a group of about six of us, including myself. She had no idea that I was the artist. And she told a story of some Russian royalty. And that had something to do with it. There was a raven in it that stole some jewelry. There was, you know, this whole wonderful story. And as she's telling the story, I'm looking at the ingredients of the piece, and I'm like, yep, that I can see how you see that, you know. And as she finished up, somebody turned and out at me as the artist and said, "So then, Dan, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, you know, that's a really accurate description based on, you know, what, you know, your own personal experiences." And yeah, it's similar. This is about royalty. This is about the dry queen families. So, you know, a different kind of royalty. So yeah, my work has, like I said, there's a lot of social issues that I address through my work. I am a socially conscious person. The materials to me bring a certain element of reflective history, where I can use history to talk about contemporary topics. It's just been a real joy to be able to work with all of you, with this stuff. I was honored to be able to be asked to be part of this show. And, you know, when I brought all this stuff in, when we were gearing it up, I'd only known a couple of the other artists, And when I saw what was being assembled, I was just like, wow, this is a great show. And I was duly impressed with everything. So that's it.
Hello, I'm Marjorie Taylor, and I made the dresses here, the long-legged animals over there, and some more over in that room. I'm a person who likes fabric, so I've done a lot of quilting and sewing and embroidering and rug hooking, and a little bit of needlepoint. Not too much needlepoint, because as some of you know, it takes a really long time to do every piece. And there are really only so many needlepoint pillows that a person absolutely wants to have. But these activities, a lot of them involve repetitive hand movements, simple movements, and I find it really meditative. I think a lot of people do. It's soothing, calming, kind of zen, and addictive. So if people are into needlepoint, they make a lot of them. And once they stop, they start another one, and they don't even often make things with them. They just end up in a closet somewhere where they can languish for years, decades, like piles of needlepoint pieces. And then somebody comes along and finds them and puts them on eBay. Mm-hmm. Well, so that was a discovery for me, that you could buy cheap but beautiful pieces of vintage needlepoint on eBay. I was all in when I found out about that. So I started bidding on them and buying them, and then using them to cover the animals that I like to make. And I just love that. I love sort of rescuing these abandoned pieces that are so beautiful. And I think the people who made them many years ago would be really happy that they're being used for something and people are looking at them and admiring them. Even though I do have to cut into them, which sometimes it's really hard to cut into a beautiful piece of needlepoint, but I do it. And it does take quite a few pieces to make the animal. So if you go into this other room, you'll see sort of a giant deer on stilts. And that piece took about 15 pieces of needlepoint to make, which is a lot. It started as a prop for a window display. I used to have a store called Velvet Edge, and I was totally obsessed with making window displays. More than selling clothes. I was making the window displays. And I needed something for a Christmas display. I thought I'd make a deer that could interact with my mannequins. But it had to be, you know, a big deer, and if I had made it life-size, it would have filled up the whole window. So my solution to that problem was to make it very tall, but kind of small. So that's why it looks like that, with the long-legged deers. It could interact with the mannequins that I had. And that worked out well. But then I kind of liked that look, so I thought, well, I need some more of these, but I didn't want to make 5-foot, you know, animals. There are only so many of those that you need. So I started making the little ones. And I've made quite a few of the little ones to show that kind of look. And also, the little ones don't take as much needlepoint, and I can use up the scraps from other animals that are bigger. So that has worked out pretty well. So moving on to my dresses. So this card dress also was a prop for a window display. It was for Valentine's Day, and I was trying to think about, where do you find hearts? Well, on playing cards, right? And it turns out that there are a lot of playing cards that are recycled from casinos. Mm-hmm. Casinos have this habit, they like to change up the cards all the time, and so they take the old decks, they clip them, and then they bring in new decks, and it's a way to stop people from cheating. And then goes on eBay, and you can buy these decks for like $1 a pack. And so I thought, okay, I'll buy, you know, a couple dozen decks, and I got a circle skirt from Nobody's Baby on 13, and I started sewing the cards onto the dress. The idea was to have a theme: are you lucky in love? You know, with these three circle cards. But I found out that I needed a lot more than 24 decks of cards. I needed so many cards. There are probably about 2,000 cards on the set. And it was, you know, I thought I was crazy when I was halfway through. I was thinking, what am I doing? But anyway, fortunately, my husband, Bill, anticipated the need for more cards, and we kept on getting boxes of cards that came to our house, and I sewed them on. And then, of course, I was only using the hearts, but it turned out that the U of O was producing a play called The Queen of Spades. And they took all the rest of the cards. They just put them all over the floor. It was really good. So this dress has had a life. It really has. It was in window displays. It was in fashion shows. It's been in fundraisers. My daughter Amber wore it at the reception for her wedding. Then it went to New Zealand, where it was a finalist in the World Wearable Art and Design, International Design Competition, and it won second place for best use of recycled materials. And then it also has been in the Mayor's Art Show locally, and it was the People's Choice Award, and it made the cover of Eugene Weekly. So I'm thinking a few of you might have seen this thing. It's been around. But this one is new, and I thought I would have a companion dress for this show. I thought I'd make it for the show, and then I was looking around to see, well, what do I have? And I had a lot of Blue Apron packing material. Some of you may know about Blue Apron. It's a business where they send you a box with recipes and then the groceries for making those meals. And I like it a lot because, you know, I don't have to worry about what to make for dinner. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of packing material in there. And so I thought, well, I should use that. And then what else do I have? Well, I had a lot of old blue jeans that were kind of worn out. I thought, well, blue jeans and the packing material, and you get the Blue Apron Diva, which is what I call that. It also has, these are the tabs from pop cans. I call it my metal lace. And then these are the zippers from all those old blue jeans. So anyway, that's what she's made out of, and she's new for the show. So anyway, those are just a few comments about some of the materials, the recycled materials that I used in the pieces in this show. And I'll just...
Michael, Dan. So at this point in the talk, we are at the Q&A section, and we're going to be doing that until about 2 o'clock, and then you're free to look around the show. We're open until 4 p.m. But I figured let's start with the Q&A.
I just read in a little statement about the show that each of the 9 artists did one of the letters in the word bricolage.
Rajiv was very clever, and there's 9 letters in bricolage, and there are 9 artists in the show. And so instead of doing our normal vinyl, we have a wonderful piece for the artists there. Yes.
I love the show. Thank you. Your presentations were wonderful. I know some of you have not worked with used materials or recycled materials, but you're artists, and you spend a lot of labor and time, and you sell your work, and people buy it, and they expect it to last a long time. So with recycled materials, and you don't really know what's in the materials, yes, they've lasted a long time already, but is there any concern with how long these materials that you find in the trash or reuse will last? And I mean, is that just a conversation that you think about for longevity when somebody pays a lot of money?
I'd say yes, for my pieces in particular, because they're volatile, because they're paper, and they're made with magazine scraps, but they are hermetically sealed with plastic, which is a finishing, and it put medium over the top, several layers of medium. So they are sealed in there, and yeah, they are volatile. And the whole time I was making the work, I'm thinking, you know, this isn't going to last, you know, 100 years, but it's going to last my lifetime, and then I'm gone, so...
Anybody else have a...
I've often thought about sort of the longevity of stuff, but I also think of this, sort of my philosophies behind it, is when I'm done with it, somebody else can take their turn, you know, and you know, I mean, and I have, there's been pieces that I've done that they've been put on display, they've seen their day, they didn't get purchased, it sits around collecting dust, and the next thing you know, that becomes something that I deconstruct and reconstruct as well. So it's not, you know, I'm not above taking my own work apart This is one of the cold fast rules that I really try to stick to, with a rare exception, is if, like, for instance, it's a piece of furniture, if it's still usable, I don't take it apart. If it's broken or damaged, then it's fair game. But if a chair still functions as a chair, it's a chair.
Wait, as long as you have the microphone, I'm so intrigued by your idea of dreaming your solutions. Is this something that you just kind of happened on in your earlier years and then trained yourself to get better at? How did you?
Well, I've always had really vivid dreams my entire life. And as a child, those dreams weren't very pleasant. They were, we'd call them nightmares, I would say. So I've always been, you know, had really vivid dreams that spoke to me in sometimes horrific ways and sometimes, you know, in more soothing ways. In recent years, in the last 25, 30 years, about 30 years ago, I participated in a group in which we we're working on a lot of different things, but we did some monitoring of our dreams as part of this group. And so we did dream journaling, where you would sit down and, you know, after you wake up in the morning, you write down what your dreams were. And that was about, you know, during that moment, it was like, just write it down. Don't worry about what it means. Just, you know, and dreams are weird. You know, I mean, I always say, you know, a dream, you're in your grandmother's house and you walk upstairs and you end up in the basement and then you jump out the window and go swimming across the ocean. And that's the way the dreams work. And somewhere along the line, I realized that I had some control over my dreams, and they no longer had to be something that frightened me, and that no longer had to be something that had control over me, that I was able to sort of direct my own dreams. And through that, and just through the process of you know, all this, and paying attention, there's like, oh, look, the dreams work this way. And now it just comes in a second nature to me.
Liability into an asset.
Yeah.
Hannah. Marjorie, you told me that these animals are a little different than your others, like the innards of them are different, and one of them you've got cock parts on that you wouldn't have done before. So tell us how they're different than your others.
So these ones are the armature is made out of wire and paper mache primarily, and so that's different. I often use forms that are used by taxidermists for other pieces that I have. I carve them a little bit and do things with them, but they're not recycled. So I didn't, none of them could be in this show. So these are all mostly paper mache underneath there.
Huh. So you do the paper mache, have it dry? How do you form it?
I wad up, I have this little wire thing, and then I just wrap a newspaper around it for a while, then I smooth it out, and then I put paper mache onto it. Lots of times, masking tape, which is the non-recycled part. Sorry. Real, brand new masking tape. Anyway, and then I cover it with paper mache. So little strips of newspaper.
And then the fabric goes
on. And then the fabric goes on top of that. And sometimes I use some clay to the parts around the eyes and stuff to make it more detailed. I will, you know, use a little clay.
They're gorgeous.
Thank you.
Joan. Marjorie, I would love to know what's involved in shipping a piece from my
house. Well, that's quite a story, actually. It turns out that the World of Wearable Art does have a shipping company that goes out of Los Angeles, and they will pay for your piece to be shipped. So I took it. There used to be a place in Eugene on Willamette where you could he shipped art, and it's not there anymore. I've noticed that that place is
packed.
Anyway, yeah, so I've asked him to do a lot of my stuff. He doesn't like to see me walking in the door because that's like so anyway, it went to Los Angeles, but actually it got lost in the warehouse, and so it missed the deadline for the show, and I contacted them, said they can't find it, and they said, well, if they can find it, if you can get it on the next ship, it can still be in the show. So then they found it, but it had been crushed.
Wow.
So they sent me a picture of the box, and it was like, oh my gosh. So I contacted the people on World War of Art, and I said, it might be destroyed, I don't know, but it's coming. And I got to tell you, playing cards are indestructible. This has been worn so many times. It was in like 20 shows, and they danced in it and everything. And it was in a museum for a year in New Zealand, and it's gone here and there. And it looks like I just made it. I mean, it's amazing. So, yes, it doesn't. Playing cards are really good if you want to make something.
Cockroach. Can I go? Can you elaborate on the recycling aspect of it? There's a lot of embodied energy in all of these things, including playing cards, that is lost when it goes into the landfill. Can you elaborate on the importance of the recycling? And also, this stuff can be used to make building materials. You can make houses out of bricolage also. Do you guys know about that?
You mean repurposing materials and creating building blocks like. And I notice they're doing that in other countries right now, putting plastics together to make blocks that then they can build.
Eco bricks,
yeah. So much goes into our landfill. There's a statistic, and I think I have it on the display in the back. By the way, I did this whole thing called the Guide to Used Goods. There's more than 100 locations where you can buy used materials in Eugene and Springfield, and I assembled all those and created a place online where you can go there with the QR code or through a website link, which is in the back there if you want that, that will show you all these different places where you can buy used goods. As far as, you know, using materials, like things having a second life, you know, this is just one way that we're repurposing materials. There should be many, many, many more ways of reusing our discards, because our landfills are just filled to the brim. We're going to be buried in garbage. We're burying our children's future in garbage. And so, I'm all about sustainability now, and how has this changed my practice? I'm probably going to stick with this. I mean, I really like the other work that I've always done, painting and sculpting and, you know, paper clay work. But, you know, the paper clay that I used is shipped in a plastic bag from Japan. All of that is costing us. You know, it's costing the future. So if the more I can do myself, I'm just doing a little thing here, but, you know, maybe our community can do more to keep things from the landfill by trying to find a second use for it.
She asked what the piece with the blue dress and asked me what the blue dress meant to me. The title of that piece will give you a hint. The title of the piece is, "As a Boy, I Like to Play with Dolls." There's lettering around the base of that using old anagram game pieces that says "Sissy Boy," and so that's, you know, that's ultimately what it, you know, where it came from. The dress itself is not something from one of the dolls I played with as a kid, but it was something that was that reminded me of that.
Thank you.
Yes, in the back. Keith, could you give another example of how your work is speaking about social justice or social things? One of your other examples, like that one?
Well, the piece is here on the wall with the shadow of the portrait of the man. That piece is actually a tribute to a real person. His name was Kurt Brousson. He was an actor. He was queer, and he lived in Poland at the beginning of World War II. He was arrested while in the middle of a play and taken off the stage by the Gestapo. And his last known whereabouts was being checked into Auschwitz. What I stumbled across him while researching someone else. And what struck me about him was it showed his records of the ancient, you know, in his records, and rather than saying what happened to him, which the Germans were really good at keeping records, you know, it said destiny unknown. And so that raised some questions for me. But at the time, when I'm in making that, for me, I interpret some of the stuff that's been happening in recent history as history repeating itself. So I'm looking at that sort of thing. The piece that's over here with the other dress piece that's down here, the title of that piece is Them. And it's a piece addressing transgender issues. That is, I tapped into one of our most famous transgender persons, Joan of Arc. She was arrested, and her crime that ultimately had her burned at the stake was wearing men's clothing. You see the bonfires around that as well. Those are some other examples.
I did have a question for Marjorie about what I'm wondering is when you transport that dress, does it collapse? When it comes into a display setting, is it supportive at that point?
I just kind of throw this thing around. If you put it on the floor, it makes a complete circle. But you know, I don't have a place to really do that, so it doesn't totally collapse. It's kind of big. It actually just does this naturally, this kind of shape. People say, how did you get it to do that? I tried to get it to not do that. And then I realized, no, that's the cool part. You know, it took me a while to realize, no, it's not supposed to be smooth and, a ball gown. It wants to do this hang in these folds. And it took me a while to just say, okay, yeah, do it.
What about the mannequins? Are those something made or old?
Yeah, the mannequins. So when I got a store, I was looking for nice mannequins and I couldn't find any because mannequins tend to be kind of plastic and ugly and not poseable. And I was traveling and I was in England and I was in a store that had these mannequins or this type here. And I loved them so much, I just said, okay, I asked, where did you get these mannequins? And it was a company in England, and I ended up just saying, okay, I'm just going to spring for it. And I got four of them, and I ended up selling the others to Anna,
Okay.
And then they, on their website, they had a picture of a mannequin with a carved arm, and I said, I want that one. And they said, no, that's a piece of art. And I said, well, who's the artist? And that person said that he would, if I sent him this design, a design I wanted on the arm, so he'd carve it for me. So he did.
Wow.
So I sent him this, and they're great because you can pose them, and when I had a great time with them, with my window displays, making them hold hands and, you know, wave at people and do things because they're really poseable. They're really, you know, but it was kind of a splurge too.
I'm curious about your process of like the paper pieces and how you make that happen. You know, all the different color variations and the tiny little pieces. I picture you with some kind of eraser and some blue. How do you do that?
I go through magazines and I rip out pages according to color. So I'm not really looking for pictures because I don't cut out the picture and use the picture. I'm just looking for fields of color. And so I have then huge piles of blues, greens, you know, separate them all out. And then, you know, and then when I'm going to do a piece, then I'm trying to find the range of colors from dark to light. And you know, so I get the dark blues and the light blues so that I can make shading. Also using type for shading, which I really like doing that, which is, you can kind of see it in that one. Yeah, but it's just a matter of, you know, keeping track of all these little bits of paper. And then I found that if you, I'm going to tell you one of my secrets. I use Elmer's glue, school glue, which you can get at all the Goodwills everywhere, to do my work. And I paint underneath it and on top of it. And then when I put the medium over the top, it's compatible and seals it up and gives it all a nice smooth finish. But yeah, I'm just working with Elmer's glue, which is, you know, it's, I think it's 99% archival.
With scissors?
With scissors, yeah.
Plain ordinary scissors.
With scissors, yeah. And sometimes I have a little paper slicer too. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'll use that. And the kids' one that I did over there was, a lot of it was torn. I usually tear to make things, but tearing magazine paper doesn't look that good because you have white edges around everything. So then I started cutting it. Yeah, so that's how I did it.